There are no streetlights on Sedgwick Road, just pitch black silence and the sound of rain hitting the pavement. Somewhere in that darkness, a police flashlight slices across the wet ground and catches the shape of a silver Chevy Cruze parked on the wrong side of the road. The driver's side windows shattered. Rainwater was running down the glass like tears. And not far from that car lies a young woman. Her name? Danielle Hoyle. Hello, and welcome to today's episode of Sleuthy Stories. If you're new here, this is the podcast where real-life mysteries unfold, one clue at a time. The audio for today's story has been pulled from my main YouTube channel and remastered for this podcast experience. If you'd like to see the visuals that accompany this case, head over to my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. But for now, sit back, listen closely, and let's unravel the mystery together. Thanks for being here. Hey there. Today's story? Well, let's just say, by the end, you're likely going to be yelling at your screen. It's a story about love and lies, the kind that look the same right up until they don't. Because when someone's really good at pretending, you don't realize what they're capable of until it's too late, when the truth is staring you right in the face. All right, here's how it all went down. That sound you just heard, that's where everything ended. But to understand how it got there, we have to go back, just a little. Memphis, Tennessee. A city that never really sleeps. Music spilling from clubs, barbecue smoke hanging in the air, and neighborhoods where everyone knows everyone. It's gritty, loud, alive. The kind of place where you feel the heartbeat of the South. But on the South side, near the old rail lines and warehouse lots, it was a different story. That night, the air was cold and heavy, rain sliding off the pavement with an ice storm on the way. The streets were quiet, too quiet, down a narrow stretch called Sedgwick Road. No bright lights, no storefronts, just an empty road where people usually dump stolen cars and hope not to get caught. That's where the call came in, late on that cold, rainy night, February 1st, 2022. What started as a routine patrol would turn into a nightmare. That night, around 11:15 p.m., Officer Cody Sutton was out on patrol from the Rains precinct. Just another cold, wet night in South Memphis. Most of his shift was routine. Stolen cars, noise complaints, the usual. But when he turned down Sedgwick Road, something caught his eye. A silver Chevy Cruze sat parked on the wrong side of the street. The windshield glistened with rain, and through the beam of his flashlight, he saw glass scattered on the ground. The driver's side window was shattered. It didn't look recent, but it didn't look right either. Sedgwick's one of those stretches people use to dump cars they don't want traced back to them. So at first, it didn't raise alarms. Still, Sutton slowed down, took another look, and ran the tag through dispatch. The name came back, Danielle Hoyle. He didn't know that name yet. To him, it was just another registration hit. Another Memphis vehicle left where it shouldn't be.
Copy that. Units will head to the registered address to make contact.
A few minutes after Officer Sutton radioed in the tag, another patrol unit pulled up to a small house a few miles away. It was the address listed for the car's owner, Danielle Hoyle. Inside, April Campbell noticed headlights slowing outside the window. After waiting for hours, she thought it was her daughter finally coming home. She even told her sons to get ready, to help Danielle bring the baby inside. But when she went to the door, it wasn't Danielle. It was a police officer. He asked for Danielle Hoyle, the owner of a silver Chevy Cruze found earlier that night on Sedgwick Road. April's heart sank a little. She asked, "Is something wrong?" The officers introduced themselves, explaining they were responding to a call about a vehicle that had been located, a silver Chevy Cruze registered to Danielle. April confirmed her daughter drove a silver Cruze. She told them Danielle wasn't home, that she'd left a few hours earlier with her newborn, Kennedy. But now, she'd been gone longer than expected. April explained she'd tried calling her about an hour after she left. Danielle had answered, saying she was getting the baby out of the car and would call her right back. But she never did. They wrote everything down, told April they'd check on a few things, and asked her to call if Danielle returned or made contact. April agreed, but the pit in her stomach was growing. She'd raised Danielle. She knew her routines, her sense of responsibility. Danielle wouldn't just go quiet. Not ever, but especially not now. So, who was Danielle Hoyle? Danielle was a 27-year-old mother of two girls, a 9-year-old, and her brand new baby, Kennedy, who wasn't even 2 days old. Earlier that same day, Danielle, Brandon, and their newborn had just left Regional 1 Hospital. Now think about that for a second. A woman who'd just given birth, literally hours ago, out in the cold with a 2-day-old infant. That's not someone who just wanders off. It makes no sense. She'd barely had time to rest, let alone recover. And the weather that night? Freezing rain, an ice storm on the way. Not exactly the kind of night a new mom decides to disappear. If you've ever met a mom fresh out of the hospital, you know she's not going anywhere that doesn't involve blankets, bottles, and sleep. So who was the man she trusted to be by her side through it all? Brandon Isabel, 25 years old. He and Danielle worked together at FedEx. That's where it all started. They hit it off in the spring of 2021, and by May, things had become more than just casual. Around that time, Danielle learned she was pregnant. By then, though, Brandon's attention wasn't entirely on her. He was seeing someone else, and even though Danielle knew, she tried to stay focused on what mattered most, the baby. By the time little Kennedy was born, the two weren't officially together, but there was still something there. They texted, they called, and they usually ended their messages with, "I love you." Even though things weren't clearly defined, one thing was, the baby. And that connection kept them in touch. When December rolled in, Brandon checked in often, asking how she was feeling and how the pregnancy was going. It wasn't dramatic, just complicated. That quiet mix of distance and hope that happens when two people aren't sure what the future holds. Then December turned into January, and the baby could come any day now. Sunday, January 30th, 2022, started like any other. According to her mom, April, she and Danielle spent the day running errands, picking up last-minute baby items, getting ready for little Kennedy's arrival. When they found out it was going to be a girl, they went all in. Matching hats and mittens, tiny bottoms and tops. If it was pink or sparkly, it was coming home with them.
She was excited about Kennedy. She sent me a picture of ultrasound saying, "Mama, guess what they found? What they found?" And she was like, "They found a baby." I had to actually just look at the picture and see her night because I thought she was playing a joke on me. But she was really excited. Everybody was excited because we thought she wasn't going to have any more kids.
By this point, Danielle already had everything a baby could need, and then some. She was ready. Later that evening, Danielle started to feel pain. She told April she couldn't walk or drive, so an ambulance was called. Because of COVID restrictions, only one person could be in the delivery room. Danielle told her mother she wanted Brandon there for the birth. Late that night, he got the message on Snapchat. Danielle was in labor. He showed up around midnight. And not long after, at 2:12 a.m., in the early hours of January 31st, baby Kennedy Caitlin Hoyle was born. Brandon was there for it. He stayed with Danielle until about 8 that morning before leaving the hospital. And you'd think that would have been a peaceful time, two new parents bonding over their baby. But even in those quiet hours, there was tension. With both parents present, it was only natural for the father to sign the birth certificate. But there was one thing. Brandon wasn't sure the baby was his. He hesitated, asking hospital staff if they could run a DNA test right then and there. They told him that wasn't something they did at the hospital. He'd have to make other arrangements. And that's where things got even more awkward. Brandon's girlfriend, Artisha, brought him one. A Walgreens DNA kit, delivered straight to the hospital, because nothing says building trust like showing up to your boyfriend's newborn's birth with a DNA test in hand. So yeah, awkward doesn't even begin to cover it. All night during Danielle's labor and delivery, Brandon was glued to his phone, working overtime to smooth things over with Artisha. They were texting through the night while Danielle was in labor because Artisha had finally had enough. She was struggling to accept that the man she'd been planning a future with was also having a baby with another woman. And not just any woman, one she knew, one she'd had words with before, thanks to a love triangle that had spilled over from work to real life. The three of them, Danielle, Brandon, and Artisha, all worked together at FedEx. Artisha was a mom herself, and Brandon came with baggage. They'd started dating in June of 2021, just a month after Danielle got pregnant. And Artisha wasn't looking to add baby mama drama to her resume. She loved him, sure, but she didn't trust him. Not just because of Danielle, but because somewhere along the way, she found out Brandon wasn't exactly single. Turns out he was still married, separated, but married, and with a 5-year-old son. Yeah, Brandon was a busy guy. So while Danielle was bringing his daughter into the world, Brandon was professing his love to Artisha, begging her to say it back. Her responses? Short, polite, and cold. She wished him and Danielle a safe delivery and told him to talk to her after the DNA results. After leaving the hospital that morning, Brandon convinced Artisha to meet up. Just hours after Kennedy's birth, he drove to Mud Island, the riverside spot the two of them called their romantic place. They met there later that morning to talk things out. The conversation didn't solve anything, but it said everything. They were still emotionally tangled. Love, guilt, jealousy, and manipulation all in the same breath. But while all that was unfolding, Danielle was focused on what mattered. Her baby. She spent those hours doing what new moms do. Texting her mom, sending pictures, glowing with that tired, beautiful kind of joy that comes right after birth. Because of COVID rules, April and the family had to wait until Danielle and Kennedy were discharged to meet the baby in person. The next day, February 1st, Danielle and baby Kennedy finally got to go home. April was at work that day, counting the hours until she could see them. She said she barely got anything done. Her phone kept lighting up with messages, photos, and updates. Everyone was excited to meet baby Kennedy. And when April finally got that chance, the visit lasted about an hour, maybe a little longer. It was one of those nights you remember for all the right reasons. Laughter, baby talk, everyone taking turns holding Kennedy. Then Danielle said she had to leave, and everything changed. When police first arrived asking who owned the Chevy Cruze, April still thought they were following up on something routine. They didn't say Danielle was hurt, only that they were checking on her car. She told them Danielle and Kennedy hadn't made it home yet, that she'd been expecting them hours ago. The officers took notes, thanked her, and left. That's when April's nerves kicked in. She started calling Danielle over and over, but there was no answer. Midnight came and went. It was now creeping past 1 a.m. Danielle's brother managed to get into her Facebook Messenger account and sent a message directly to Brandon. He told him they were looking for Danielle and the baby, that they needed to come see him. "What's the address?" Brandon's reply was short, confused. "Huh? Who is this?" But it didn't take him long to realize this was serious, and they weren't playing. Meanwhile, messages were also hitting Brandon's parents' phones, friends and family, demanding to know where Danielle was. By then, Brandon had gotten the message loud and clear. He'd spent most of the night texting Artisha, and they'd already planned to meet up later at her place once she finished a few errands. Brandon got there first. When Artisha pulled up moments later, he came straight outside to meet her. She barely made it through the doorway before Brandon jumped into her car, panicked, saying they needed to leave. He told her that, after dropping off the baby clothes, Danielle stopped responding. That Danielle's family was out looking for him, saying Danielle and the baby were missing and demanding answers. Confused and alarmed, Artisha drove him to his parents' home in Cordova, where he was living at the time. They arrived roughly 15 minutes after Brandon first got that message. Once there, Brandon went inside and talked with his parents, who confirmed they too had been getting messages about Danielle. And that's when Brandon broke down crying. The officers who'd spoken to April radioed their report back to Officer Sutton, who was still on Sedgwick Road with the car. They told him Danielle Hoyle wasn't home, that she'd left earlier that night and had taken her newborn Kennedy with her. No one had heard from her since. So Sutton stepped out of his cruiser and approached the rain-soaked vehicle for a closer look. The night was nearly pitch black, the rain steady and cold. On the ground near the driver's side, he spotted a pool of blood, and just beyond it, shattered glass. Then something else caught his eye. Bright pink sneakers. Moments later, he realized what he was seeing. The body of a young black woman, lying face down beside the car, partly in a ditch. She had been shot multiple times. He called for backup. As officers processed the scene, they noticed there was no baby, no car seat, no Kennedy anywhere. Inside the cruise, they found a small diaper bag embroidered with Kennedy, the only sign the newborn had ever been there. Within hours, the Memphis Police Department issued a city watch alert for the missing infant. What started as a stolen vehicle call had just become a homicide with a missing baby. Once homicide detectives were activated, Officer Sutton's role shifted from patrol to investigation. He was assigned to meet again with April, but when he got to her home, she was gone. She and her sons rushed to the Raines precinct, where police locked the doors behind them as the investigation intensified. Even then, April didn't know the truth. She still believed they were trying to locate Danielle and Kennedy. When Officer Sutton found her at the precinct, she'd been moved for questioning. He delivered the devastating news. Officers had located Danielle's vehicle, and a female victim found deceased beside it, though the identity hadn't yet been officially confirmed. He informed April that police were now investigating a homicide. April told officers that Danielle had gone to meet Brandon Isabel that night, and that baby Kennedy was with her. Later, it wouldn't be Danielle's brother who showed up at his parents' house. It was the police. When officers arrived, both Brandon and Artisha were detained by the Memphis Police Department. They were separated and interrogated for hours. Detectives from Homicide took Brandon's interview. Their first priority was finding baby Kennedy. They already knew where Danielle was, but they weren't sharing those details yet. After reading him his rights, they began what would turn out to be a grueling interrogation that stretched nearly 10 hours. They knew Brandon was the last person to see Danielle alive, so that's where they started. And the lies began to flow. Brandon told them he and Danielle had met at a MAPCO gas station, near where her car was later found. He said they met so he could give her some clothes for the baby. According to him, Danielle left the MAPCO parking lot with Kennedy after they talked. He claimed she drove away, saying she was going to McDonald's, and that was the last time he saw her. He said he went home after that. When detectives asked how the baby was doing, Brandon said she was asleep in the back seat. But they weren't buying it. They already knew the baby and the car seat weren't at the scene with Danielle. The timeline didn't fit, and nothing about Brandon's demeanor matched the story. So they pushed. They convinced him to hand over his phone for extraction. Brandon signed a consent form giving them the passcode and permission to pull everything: calls, messages, GPS data, browser history. It was a smart move by detectives. They already suspected the truth. They gave him space, just enough rope to hang himself. After so many lies and stories that made no sense, they told him it was time to be honest. His timeline was off. And they told him who they really were: homicide detectives. They weren't looking for a missing person. They were investigating a murder. From that point on, the tone in the room changed. They told him flat out, "We know you're not being honest, and we can prove it." He was caught, and he knew it. Still trying to control the narrative, Brandon switched gears again. Detectives pressed harder, warning him they had surveillance, GPS data, the works. They asked where Danielle and the baby were. Brandon hesitated. Then they asked about his gun, the one he was known to carry all the time. He said he didn't have it that day. Convenient. Detectives also had something else: his phone messages. Texts he sent after Danielle had already been killed, saying, "Show me Kennedy. I'm gonna take her tomorrow. Give her a kiss for me. Love y'all." They confronted him. "Why didn't she respond?" Brandon said, "I don't know." The detectives leaned in. "Yeah, you do." Then one of them said it plain. "We don't think we've got the right guy. We know we've got the right guy." After being pressed hard, with detectives threatening him about the evidence and the lies stacking up, Brandon changed his story. He claimed he met Danielle at MAPCO again, same place, same setup. But this time, he added a twist. He said he drove down a road he wasn't familiar with, claiming he had car trouble. He admitted to being with Danielle and Kennedy longer than he'd said before. According to Brandon, they pulled over and talked. He said Danielle was weak, upset, not feeling right after giving birth, that she needed to rest. And that's when, according to him, she handed him the baby. He said he left with Kennedy, thinking Danielle would be fine, and that he had no idea what happened to her after that. He told detectives he took the baby to the river. That stopped everything. The detectives locked in, eyes up. "Did you put the child in the river?" Brandon hesitated, then said, "No." They pushed a map toward him and told him to show them where. He pointed. The spot. The old boat ramp down on Mud Island, where the Mississippi and the Wolf River meet. He said the baby was alive, still in her car seat when he left her there. Detectives retraced his supposed route across the A.W. Willis Bridge onto Island Drive, all the way down to the water. As soon as they had a clear location, one of the detectives quietly slipped out of the room to start mobilizing search teams. In a matter of minutes, he'd gone from an ex-boyfriend with a helpful story to a rescuer, the man who supposedly saved the baby, to something far worse: a man who could walk away from a child in conditions no one could survive. Brandon kept pretending he didn't know what happened to Danielle, but the detectives weren't letting up. They reminded him that Sedgwick Road was monitored, that there were cameras, evidence, eyes everywhere. The walls were closing in, and that's when it happened. Just like that, he confessed to shooting Danielle. Only the killer could have known that detail. He didn't just shoot Danielle once. He shot her multiple times at close range. Her Chevy Cruze began to roll backward. Brandon dragged her out, leaving her face down, partly in a ditch. Then he took the baby and her car seat. That's why Officer Sutton didn't see Danielle right away, because Brandon had already moved her. The detectives pressed Brandon harder, trying to figure out if anyone helped him. Did he tell anyone? What did Artesia know? Brandon said he was alone, that he'd told Artesia the same story he told police, that he'd left Danielle and couldn't get in touch with her. And then, unbelievably, Brandon started to feel sorry for himself. He'd just confessed to killing Danielle, and somehow he made himself the victim. He complained about ruining his birthday, about trying to get his life together, about child support, about females, meaning Artesia, not wanting him. Seriously? You end a new mom's life, and you're the one having a bad day? That's not remorse, that's narcissism, cold, self-absorbed, detached from the devastation he caused. The officers who went to Mud Island didn't find the baby, so they did the next logical thing. They packed Brandon up and took him down to the old boat ramp, the exact spot he claimed to have left her. As investigators learned from Brandon's statement that he'd gone to Mud Island, the search for baby Kennedy Hoyle became a full-scale, multi-agency operation. When they got there, it was chaos and heartbreak all at once. Search teams, divers, boats, helicopters, K-9 units, everyone was out. The river churned with searchlights and hope. Divers fought the current, officers scanned the shoreline, and helicopters hovered overhead. They didn't find her, but they found something that proved she'd been there, a tiny baby cap lying on the ground at the old boat ramp, spotted as officers scoured the area. Then the weather turned. An ice storm was rolling in, forcing the search to end early. So detectives brought Brandon back to the precinct. Again, he was still lying, still trying to outtalk the truth. He admitted that after killing Danielle, he drove around for a while before heading home, baby still in the car. Once there, he hung up his jacket, changed clothes, grabbed a blue bag, and swapped his Adidas slides for Crocs because Danielle's blood had splattered on the slides. When officers later collected the clothes Brandon was wearing at the time of his arrest, one detail stood out. As they removed the black socks he had on, they noticed another pair, white socks underneath. And on those white socks, reddish-brown stains, possible blood. When investigators searched his white Chevy Malibu, they opened the trunk and found the Adidas slides, the very pair Brandon had been wearing when he shot Danielle. Back in the interrogation room, detectives still didn't know where the baby was. They stepped out briefly, and when they came back, Brandon had yet another story ready. This time, he said while he and Danielle were talking, he heard something behind him and fired. He said it wasn't his intention to do it. But again, it made zero sense. How do you hear something behind you and end up shooting the person in front of you? 5 times. The detectives didn't waste breath on that excuse. They went right back to the real question. Where's the baby? Brandon stuck to his story, that he'd left Kennedy in her car seat by the dock, by the water, but not in it. He claimed he'd tossed his gun into the river, but the baby, according to him, was still on land. But detectives already knew he was lying, because hours earlier, they'd gotten a tip. A Good Samaritan had spotted a baby car seat behind the Walmart on Elvis Presley Boulevard and called it in. GPS data from Brandon's phone put him there around 12:20 a.m., right after what police believe now to be 2 murders. Officer Blake responded to the call. He found the car seat, the same one Danielle had used to bring Kennedy home from the hospital, sitting beside a locked dumpster out of view from the main parking lot. Alongside it was a tiny mitten, matching the cap found at the riverbank. Brandon had driven behind the building, dropped the car seat by the dumpster, and left. For hours, he kept insisting the baby was still at the dock, safe in her seat. He wouldn't admit what everyone in that room already knew, until finally, after 3 long hours of questioning, the lies ran out. The motive couldn't have been clearer. It was written out, right there on Danielle's Apple Watch, in a message Brandon sent to her 5 months into her pregnancy. Long before the crime ever took shape, the motive was already in motion. Brandon wrote, "I can't be a father to the kid right now, Danielle, and I don't want to put you through that. I have to be a father to my first child. I haven't been doing that. I don't want you to go through what you're going through with Raya's dad not being around twice. You deserve better than what I've been doing to you. If you love me like you say you do, then let's end our mistake, Danielle. Let's talk to these doctors tomorrow and have them understand where we're coming from. I gotta sit back and find myself with no distractions, for real, for real. I gotta find me." Danielle replied, "Brandon, just stop texting me and go about your business. I don't need you. And talking to them? They're still not going to do it. I'm going on 5 months now." Even back then, she knew what kind of man she was dealing with. He was already calculating how to erase her and their baby from his future. As the investigation continued, detectives realized this was darker than they'd imagined. Brandon hadn't snapped. He'd planned it. He filed for divorce just 4 days before Danielle gave birth. His way of starting fresh, only days before ending 2 lives. Then, the day before Kennedy's birth, January 30th, his phone searches told the rest of the story. At 5:42 p.m., he Googled, "Can all bullets be traced back to the exact gun that fired them? Can you tell what gun a bullet came from?" And then, 29 seconds later, he searched NBA games today. Moments after researching gun forensics, he was checking basketball scores. That's how cold it was. Later that night, he was browsing Jared's jewelry website, scrolling through wedding rings, even reaching the cart page. Homicide and honeymoon planning, all in one browser session. While he toggled between murder prep and everyday distractions, Danielle was nesting, shopping for last-minute baby items, folding onesies, preparing to meet her daughter. And then, as Danielle brought new life into the world, Brandon was already figuring out how to take it away. He stood there at the hospital, holding the child he would soon kill, smiling for photos, then walking out that morning, his plans already in motion. By the morning of February 1st, the day of the murders, GPS data confirmed what detectives already suspected. Brandon had been scouting locations, driving up and down Mart Road, a narrow, pitch-black stretch near Sedgwick Road, the same area where Danielle would later be found. That night, he lured her to the Mapco gas station, pretending he wanted to drop off baby clothes. Once she got there, he convinced her to follow him down a dark, empty road, claiming he was having car trouble. Danielle, always willing to help, pulled her car in front of his, turning on her headlights to give him light. That's when he walked around to the passenger side of her car, opened the door, and shot her 5 times, killing her instantly. As the gunfire echoed, her car began to roll backward. Brandon pulled her out, leaving her face down, partly in a ditch. He wasn't fixing a car. He was clearing his path, erasing anything or anyone that could get in the way of the life he wanted with Artesia, the woman who was already pulling away from him because of his chaos, a wife, a divorce, and now, a new baby. She didn't want any part of it. Evidence showed Artesia wasn't involved. While Brandon was setting his plan in motion, she was downtown running errands, completely unaware. He kept texting her the whole time, saying he was out grabbing dinner for his birthday. Dinner wasn't dinner. It was his alibi, his code for murder. He texted Artesia all evening, right up until the moment he killed Danielle. Between 9:04 and 9:22 p.m., his messages went silent. That 20-minute gap is when detectives believe Danielle Hoyle was murdered. At 9:23 p.m., the texts started again, right after he'd fled with baby Kennedy. Then at 11:13 p.m., preparing to do the unthinkable to his infant daughter, he texted Artisha, "Just left the house. When you gonna be around?" He wasn't at the house. He was at the river. After returning from the boat ramp with the officers and roughly 10 hours of questioning, Brandon finally admitted to what the detectives feared, but already knew deep down. They took turns pressing him, circling the same question over and over. "Did you throw that baby in the river, Brandon?" Hours passed. One lie after another collapsed under its own weight, until he finally spoke. Flat, detached, almost casual. "Did you push the baby into the water, Brandon?" "No." "Did you place the baby into the water?" "Yes." "Who placed the baby into the water, Brandon?" "Me." "Did you place the baby into the water, or did you toss it?" He said quietly, "I tossed it." "It didn't go as far as the gun," he said. And would you believe, minutes later, after killing both Danielle and Kennedy, he stopped at Walgreens to buy a stuffed animal, a rose, and a card, then lingered in the parking lot to write a love note to Artisha about raising Kennedy together. "They're three kids," he wrote, knowing full well the baby was already gone. At 11:39 p.m. and 12:02 a.m. from that same parking lot, he texted Danielle's phone, "Show me Kennedy. I'm gonna take her tomorrow. Give her a kiss for me. Love y'all." He was texting a dead woman, trying to make it look like she was still alive. Then at 12:13 a.m., he messaged Artisha again. "I want to cuddle tonight. I ain't slept with you in a week." By then, he was already on his way to Walmart to dump the last trace of the problem standing between him and his perfect little fantasy life. In the end, the evidence told its own story. Brandon Isabel had confessed to killing Danielle Hoyle and baby Kennedy. But even without his words, the proof was everywhere. Those stains on the white socks, they were indeed Danielle's blood. The Tennessee Bureau of Investigation confirmed it, matching her DNA to both the socks Brandon wore and the Adidas slides he tried to hide in his trunk. Even though the gun was never found, detectives had everything else they needed. A holster, a 9mm magazine, and Hornady brand rounds identical to the casings scattered in and around Danielle's car, all pointing straight back to Brandon. Still, when the case went to trial, his defense team tried to spin it. They claimed his confession had been forced, that detectives had pushed too hard, that he only said what they wanted to hear. And when that fell apart, they aimed their blame at Artisha, the woman who wanted no part in his chaos. They treated her like a third-party culprit, pointing to a gun found during the search of her home. But her weapon was a total mismatch, different make, different caliber, zero connection to the murder scene. In legal terms, this case wasn't circumstantial. It was caught in 4K. Every digital breadcrumb, every GPS ping, every lie Brandon told, it all led straight back to him. The jury saw right through it. Brandon Isabel was found guilty on all counts for the murders of Danielle Hoyle and baby Kennedy Hoyle and multiple weapons charges. The judge sentenced him to 3 life terms, 2 for the murders of Danielle and baby Kennedy, and 1 for a related weapons conviction. They'll be served concurrently, meaning he'll be eligible for parole after 51 years. No plea deal, no early release. Brandon Isabel wanted a clean slate, a new start, a simpler life. But instead of taking responsibility, he took 2 lives that never stood in his way. By law, because he never signed the birth certificate, he wasn't even recognized as Kennedy's father, a non-relative in the eyes of the court. Sole custody and responsibility were Danielle's alone. He didn't want the obligation, but he already had the out. He could have just walked away. Danielle even told him that months before, "Go on about your business, and I don't need you." He could have chosen to be another absent father. And while that's not admirable, it's a far better choice than the one he made. Brandon wanted freedom, but he didn't free himself. He just traded one kind of sentence for another. He said he wanted to find himself. Well, maybe. He finally did. The day he witnessed his daughter's first breaths, then had the audacity to take her mother's last. That's the story of Danielle and baby Kennedy Hoyle. Thank you, from the bottom of my heart, for being here with me. If you want more stories like this, don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you in the next one. That wraps up this episode of Sleuthy Stories. Thanks for joining me as we uncover the twists and turns of real-life cases. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a moment, please leave a rating. It really helps more true crime fans find us. Want to see the visuals that go with today's case? You can find the full video version on my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. Check the link in the description. I'll be back soon with another case. But until then, keep your wits sharp and your curiosity sharper.